Today is January 29th, 2013. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Letcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I am interviewing Tom Farrell over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Tom, can you begin with when and where you were born?
Hi, Desiree. Sure. My name is Tom Farrell, and I was born January 18th, 1944, in New York City. So I grew up in New York City.
And what were your earliest involvement in sports?
As a kid growing up, I played all sports. I favored baseball. We played football and basketball and did all of the things that, you know, normal kids did, but centered on playing baseball. So starting, I guess, 6 or 7 years old, my father always played catch with me and stuff like that. And I always knew I could run. I always knew I was the fastest kid on the block. But there was no focus on athletics. It was more on playing baseball because we had a couple of baseball players in the family, and that's all we ever wanted to do was play baseball. So that's my first recollection of any kind of physical activity in regards to sports.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any major sports heroes or anybody that you looked up to or that really motivated you in sports at the time?
Growing up, my family was from Brooklyn, so we really liked the Brooklyn Dodgers. I was brought up as a Dodger fan, so I liked Duke Snider and Jackie Robinson and Pee Wee Reese and all of the Dodgers, you know, the most common names. Then when the Dodgers left Brooklyn and settled in L.A., became a Yankee fan, and then the god in our house was Mickey Mantle. So he was kind of an idol, always liked Mickey Mantle. So he was the guy.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, when did you first get into track or athletics participation?
First time was as a kid. I always, as I said before, I always knew I was fast, and I always knew that I could beat anybody. I always was confident in that. And I always knew that if it came to a race that I could beat anybody. But there were no track meets, but just playing tag and, you know, running the first base or playing football or doing any kind of running, I always knew that I was faster than anyone. And then when I started high school, which was in 1957, I went out for the baseball team. And they came to me and said, "You're too small. We're going to cut you from the team." So I wanted to participate in a sport, so I went out for track, and that's the first time. I was 13 years old. I was at Archbishop Mollet High School, which is in Queens, New York, and I started running track as a freshman. So that was the first time I'd ever actually run a race. First race I ever ran was they had an intramural race for freshmen, and that was cool. And they had a freshman. And in the freshman class, there were probably 300 and some odd. It was an old boys' school. So beginning of the year in September, they had a intramural track meet just for freshmen. So they put everybody in different races. So they selected me to run a certain race. So that was the first race I had ever run. And I won that race. And then when I got dropped from the baseball team, because they said I was too small and all of that, I went out for the track team.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about some of the highlights from your early track career.
My times continued to drop from my freshman year. I ran 800 in 215. My sophomore year, I ran 159. My junior year, I ran 157. And my senior year, I ran 153. So my times continued to improve. As a junior, our team won the 2 mile relay at the Penn Relays, which was a big win. We all got watches. We're all kind of jazzed about that. Yeah. And then my senior year, I won the national championships in Madison Square Garden, and I won every race in my senior year. And then I got a scholarship to St. John's University, which was just about a couple of miles away from where my high school was. So what I remember the most about being a runner at Archbishop Molloy High School was that you know, the school had maybe 1,200 guys in it, and there were about 200 plus on the track team. And it wasn't that everyone was going to do what I did, but what the opportunity that the school gave the kids was that gave them a chance to do something. You got a chance to participate, got a chance to, you know, build your body, got a chance to have friends, got a chance to stay off the streets, got some discipline and structure in high school. So everyone, because of track and field, it's there's always a race for everyone. Everyone can run in a race pretty much every weekend, where in basketball there's only 12 guys or so that play. In baseball, it's a limited number. But in track, it gave every kid an opportunity to participate and do something and to hopefully feel good about themselves and advance through life that way. So those are some of the real fun things that I remember about you know, high school track and being in my high school years.
Sure. Well, moving on to track participation after high school, can you go over the highlights of what that was like before the 64 trials?
All right. I graduated from high school in 61. I had an athletic scholarship to St. John's. We had a promising team. We had a bunch of good guys. And then my times pretty much improved and my performances improved each year. From my freshman year, back in those days, in the early 60s, you only had 3 years of varsity competition, and freshmen competed against freshmen. So your first year was you competed against other freshmen, and you didn't get to varsity or compete in NCAA meets and those types of things until at least your sophomore year. So things are a lot different these days than they were back then. So I did well as a freshman. My times improved over high school. I improved my second year. At the end of my sophomore year, one thing I do remember is that I did not make the IC4A, which is the East Coast kind of a conference meet with perhaps maybe 80 schools or so that participate in a championship in the June timeframe. This is before the NCAA championships. And what I do remember is that in the IC4A, I did not make the finals in the 800, and I was kind of disappointed and didn't ever want that to happen. 12 months later, I made the Olympic finals in Tokyo. So I went from not making the conference final to making the Olympic final in Tokyo. So, it was pretty exciting time to do that. Making Olympic team, winning NCAA championships, and that were pretty exciting. So that, and then I had one more year left in school, and I defended my NCAA championship in the 800. Excuse me. And then after that, I went into the service. So I had a great opportunity to compete for St. John's. They gave me a chance to go to school, get an education, meet a lot of people, and do well. So it was kind of exciting.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, how did your family and friends react to your success in the NCAA and also making an Olympic team?
They're pretty excited. I won the NCAA championships in 1964 in Eugene, Oregon, and it was a meet that I didn't want to go to. The prior year, as I said, I didn't make the finals in the IC. Okay. In 1964, I won the IC4A championships, and my time was enough to qualify for the NCAAs, which were in Eugene, Oregon. And I told the coach, I said, it's been a long year. I said, maybe we should pass on this and take the time off. And he says, no, we're going to go to the NCAA championships, and hopefully you'll qualify for the Olympic trials and make the Olympic team. And I said, sure. So I followed his direction, and we went out to the NCAAs and made it through the first round, made it through the second round. And coming off the last turn in the finals of the 800, the guy in front of me from USC, he just kind of moved aside a little bit, and I passed him on the inside, and I won the race. When I finished, I hadn't really realized I won, and the coach his name is Bob Gegengack, coach of Yale, he was also going to be the head coach of the 64 Olympic team. He came over to me right after the race, and he said, congratulations. And I said, for what? He said, you just won the race. And I said, I did. You know, I was more surprised than anyone. So when I got back, the race happened to be on Father's Day. And when I got off the plane flying back to New York, my dad, I presented the medal to my dad as a Father's Day gift. So he was kind of really, really pleased. He'd go to every track meet. My parents would go to all the track meets that I ran. So it was kind of exciting. So it was a lot of support from my family and friends. So things worked out.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, tell me about the 64 games in Tokyo and what that was like.
It was incredible to realize that, you know, a dream, when I thought back, you know, every kid growing up in grade school always does a project on the Greek Olympics and, you know, getting a medal or having the olive wreath placed on your head and getting all these awards and being recognized as, you know, one of the best in the world and all of that. And studying that and doing all the different little projects that you do, to realize that sometime later in your life that you'd be part of the Olympic team was just sort of mind-boggling. In a nutshell, I had never basically competed out of the New York area through high school and through college. We'd maybe go to Virginia, maybe go to Pennsylvania once a year, maybe somewhere in New Jersey, maybe in Boston, but never outside kind of the Northeast corridor. And to realize that all of a sudden, I mean, you're in the Olympic finals in Tokyo was just a thrill, competing against guys you'd only read about in the papers and in track and field periodicals. So it was a tremendous experience to go get fitted for the uniforms, you know, go through all the different trials that you have to go through, and then placing in the top three, and then, you know, group, no longer looking in, but part of. It was just a tremendous thrill to represent the U.S. and the Tokyo Olympics, and to be so far away from home, and to be part of the whole experience of being in Tokyo, marching in the parade, you know, seeing other athletes, just walking around, living with them, eating with them, was just a tremendous thrill to be part of it. So something you never sort of forget. So I began my training like about a week after the Tokyo Olympics for the next Olympics, because in 1964 I was 20 years old and I thought I was maybe too young. So I had 4 years to prepare for the Mexico Games. So it was a fantastic time in my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, how was your training supported? I mean, did you have a job at that time? And how did you get the time and the money to be able to train?
Well, in 64, I was a junior in college. So the answer was I had no money and you trained at school. And once you got to a certain level, then meets around the world and in the United States, they would invite you. So they would pay for your way to go. My training would be just at school. And then on weekends, I'd fly somewhere to compete in a track meet. So there was no money. The per diem you would get, they would pay for your hotel room and give you like about $20 a day to buy food. But there was actually, you know, there was no money. So it was all truly an amateur sport back then. You did it because you loved to run, and you did it because you either want to represent, you know, your family, your school, your country, and you did it for those specific reasons, not for any other reason. Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit different thought back then than it was today.
Mm-hmm. And then what about after the 64 games and leading up to the 68 games? Were you in the service then, or?
Yeah, I graduated from school in 66, got married, and then there was a thing called the draft. Although I didn't get drafted, I enlisted in the service. There was a military obligation back then, and if you were able-bodied, Uncle Sam would just sort of say, I want you and you're coming, and you have no choice. So I kind of knew what was going to happen. The sports back in the 60s and even before that, the Olympic team was comprised of mainly a lot of college kids, some people in the service, and then a few individuals who were a little bit older that maintained training and fitness and continued to compete. So that back when I went in the service, kind of knew what was going to happen. They put us in a place to train, and it was a great opportunity to you know, live and be with guys that do the same thing and the same caliber of individual that I did. So it was a great opportunity to continue training and get the military obligation out of the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, did the amount of time and effort that you put into training take away from any of your work duties or any of your relationships, for example? Did you ever feel like you were missing out on spending time with your wife because you were busy training?
No, I can't say that. My wife and I, we were living in California. I was stationed in California, in Los Angeles, and we lived off base. So she was teaching school. So we had an apartment, and we had friends that lived around with their wives. You know, same from the Army and other runners. So we had a circle of friends. So she went out to teach every day, and then I would go train with the other guys. So I can't say as we ever missed anything. You have to sacrifice a lot to be at a certain level. You know, you have to be focused on the goal that you wanted. And I thought for many years I always was goal-oriented and always had, you know, the object of winning an Olympic gold medal and setting a world record. So not only making the team, but then winning and setting a world record. So that was the goal that I had. And you would do everything to try to get to that, mm-hmm. to get that goal.
Right. Well, can you describe your path to the 68 team trials and what the trials were like?
Well, I as I said before, I started to mentally prepare and start thinking about the 68 games when I was sort of a week after the Tokyo Olympics. So it began a four-year kind of a process. So being in the Army from graduating from school in 66, took training. Then after basic training, we were kind of assigned to the track team. So we had an opportunity to train. And so went on a training schedule of for about 16 months with a couple of guys. We trained real hard for one specific purpose, and that was to be in the best shape of our lives for the 1968 Olympic trials, which were in South Lake Tahoe. So, you know, everything was geared for kind of one race, because if you don't make the Olympic trials and you don't make the team, you watch it on TV or you read about it in books. So I didn't want that to happen. So we trained real hard. Things worked out well for me.
Yeah, right. Well, were there any particular challenges or anything really interesting that happened in the trials? For example, I read that you actually won those trials, correct?
I did win the trials, yeah. Going through the trials, the final trials were in September of 68. The Olympics themselves were in October. In February time frame, in an indoor meet in New York City, I broke a bone in my foot. So I'd gone through doing a lot of heavy training and all of that, and I guess it was some sort of a stress fracture in my foot, but it was definitely, you could definitely in the x-ray see a separation. So you get kind of, you know, you ask for things that sort of happen, and this was something that could have been very bad. It was bad, but I kept positive, and I thought that from January to September was a long time and that the bone will heal. And if I take care of myself, do some kind of alternate types of training, you know, I can stay in somewhat halfway decent shape. And then once the foot gets healed, I can get back into training and still be ready. So I was still focused and positive. And so I was on crutches for about a month and then had to be real careful. And I resumed training after about 2 months. So, you know, things that can happen if you don't have the proper frame of mind and focused and say, yes, I can, then you know, might never get to where you want to get. So when the bone broke, I tried to keep very positive.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the major thing that kind of set me off. You know, I didn't want it to happen, so but it did happen, and I was able to get back into shape and win the trial. So I was pretty excited about that.
Definitely. Well, how did your friends and family react to your winning the trials?
That was great. We the trials, because Mexico was at 72 or 7,300 feet, the USOC picked the place and picked Lake Tahoe as the place to train at the same elevation. So they converted an old ski run into a six-lane track in the kind of high up in the mountains in the woods. They put a track in, around the trees, so that on the infield of the track were these huge trees, and it was kind of a great place to live. So we got acclimated by staying there for a couple of months prior to the trials, and then stayed a few weeks, and then went off to Mexico, so that we got kind of acclimated to the elevation. So things worked out pretty well, and it was a great plan. It was a great place to be in South Lake Tahoe. You know, you had the casinos, and you had places to keep busy and things like that. And being in the Army, that's not such bad duty. So, and my wife was able to come up and spend, you know, time up at South Lake Tahoe. We rented a house for a couple of months, and it was really great.
Oh, that does sound nice. Mm-hmm. Well, did you notice the effects of the high altitude at first when you first arrived in Lake Tahoe and began training there?
I was kind of worried about the altitude, because in 65, I went to a pre-Olympic meet in Mexico City, and I wasn't in good shape, but it was kind of miserable running. They had a few pre-Olympic meets. They had a meet, I guess, each year at the same in October at the stadium in Mexico. And so I went down a couple of times for that. And being not in great shape, I had some problems. I didn't run well. When we got to Mexico City, South Lake Tahoe, I was in much better shape. And I kind of took my time getting acclimated. And after a short period of time, really didn't have any problems. So the event I ran was the 800. That's kind of right on the border, whether or not it helps or hurts. So I think we could have run faster at sea level. But in the events shorter than the 800, definitely was to the advantage running at altitude. Events higher than that at a disadvantage. So the 800 was kind of the middle ground, whether mm-hmm. it helped or not. Mm-hmm. So,
well, was there anyone on the team with whom you were particularly close? You know, after spending so much time together at Lake Tahoe and, you know, just preparing for the games, did you have any good friends on the team?
Yeah, I had, being that I was more of a veteran now, because I already been on one Olympics, I knew pretty much everyone who was on the team. So I stayed close with the other guys who were in the Army with me, and Mel Pender and a guy named Bob Day and a guy named Tom Von Ruden and a few others. And I roomed with a guy named Ron Kaczynski, who was one of the 800 meter runners. So we became pretty close friends. And there's another guy named Tom Laris who ran the distance races.
Leading up to actually going down to Mexico City for the games, did you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. team?
Oh yeah, that was constantly going on. One of the things that we were kind of guided against was, being that you're in the Army and you belong to Uncle Sam, was that you better stay neutral. So I know a lot of the black athletes were forming groups, and there was something that was going to happen, but no one kind of knew what was going to happen. But as far as my participation or mine, you know, the military said, you stay neutral, you know. And even Mel Pender, who was a private in the Army, and he was on the 64 team, and he was also on the 68 team, and we were very close friends. And he was kind of my company commander. He was Captain Pender. And they told him, they said, Mel, if you speak up or do anything, he said, you might be on the next plane to Vietnam. So, you know, we always, one of the things was you knew something was going to happen, but didn't know what was going to happen, but they said, stay neutral.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you or anyone on your team ever receive a letter from the Harvard crew team or the 68 rowing team about the Olympic Project for Human Rights?
I do remember something about that, and I became more familiar with it. You know, as time goes by, you sort of forget things. You know, this is like almost 50 years ago. But I did read a book over the summer called In Thin Air. I can't remember who the author was, but it was a book on the 68 experience, and they talked a lot about the Harvard crew team and that. And I kind of knew they were sending. I did receive information. I can't remember much more than that, but kind of just kept to the guidelines. What the military said was that stay neutral.
Right.
You know, and I didn't want to go to Vietnam.
Absolutely.
So, and plus you know, when you're in the Army, you belong to them. So I thought that anything that could help individuals, I thought was a great thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what the Harvard Crew Team was trying to do with the Human Rights Project.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you remember hearing anything about student protests and violence in Mexico City about 10 days before the start of the games?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was on TV, and there was a lot of discussions about it. I don't know if we took a vote or we might have been briefed in some of the meetings at Tahoe before we went. But I kind of took the attitude that, you know, even in Tokyo, for instance, in Tokyo, they said the guys who went to Tokyo in the year before, 1963, they said, Tokyo will never be prepared for the Olympics. Will never be prepared. They're so far behind. And they seem to get everything done like midnight the night before the Olympic Games started in Tokyo. So I kind of kept that in mind, that no matter what's going on, you can't concern yourself too much with things that you have no control of, and that, you know, you're going to go regardless of anything, where the plane's going and you're on the plane and you're going to the Olympic Games. So that I kind of thought whatever was happening, you just keep going and not worry about it. But there was something happening. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Oh, my phone was beeping. So anyway, but I do recall there were mass slaughters, and I guess there were hundreds of people that were killed, and it's a tragic shame. When you get down to Mexico, the people were, I've never met a group of individuals and just the average person that was so helpful. If you were walking and someone would just stop and say, you need a ride? And you say, well, I have to go 8 miles away. He says, we'll take you. They would do basically anything to make you stay there as best as possible. And you got there, you realized it didn't seem like anything had ever happened. It was such a joyful, happy time. And, you know, everything, shame they lose lives, but didn't really have any effect other than it was sad that there were lives lost. And more of the truth came out, I think, years later. I don't think we knew what was really what happened.
Right, right. That's true. Well, you already mentioned a little bit your impressions of the people of Mexico City, but what were your impressions of the city itself when you first arrived?
Well, it was my third trip there, I liked it the first time. I never really liked Mexico City. I went there on business a couple of years back, and I loved Mexico City. But when I went there, I thought it was dirty. I don't know. I didn't like it. I didn't like the altitude. I didn't like the city. I didn't like a lot of things. But that was my basic opinion of the city. The first time I went in 1965, I liked it. I did all the touristy things. And then I went the following year, and I liked it less. And then when I went for the Olympics, I just wanted to compete and leave. So I thought it was a great opportunity to be there, but I was also glad to leave the place.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you think of the event venues and the athletic facilities?
I thought it was okay. I was able to see, I think I saw the final basketball game, because we bribed the guy to get in. We gave him money to get in the front door. And I went to a few other events. I know after my event, I went to Acapulco for a few days with my wife to vacation and came back. But I thought everything was good. I thought it was difficult getting around. You know, I didn't have a car or anything like that. But I thought I thought it was a wonderful time and would never trade the experience. But I still thought that Tokyo, you know, had that fresh in my mind from 4 years ago. So, but I loved Mexico City. I loved being there, but I didn't really like it. So,
mm-hmm. Well, you said your wife came and you guys went to Acapulco afterwards.
Yeah, during we went for a few days, basically during the Olympics. Once I finished competing, then we flew to Acapulco for a few days just to go to Acapulco. She was with a track and field tour. Track and field news is kind of the Bible of the sport, and they had a track and field tour. So she was part of that, and She was staying in a place called Via Coapa. So I stayed either at the Olympic Village or I stayed with her at this place, which was, I guess, not too far away.
Mm-hmm.
But it was some high-rise buildings that they built for the games, and then I guess to use for medium income kind of housing for the games.
Right. Well, did you have any other family members come down to watch you compete?
No, just her. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
No one else.
Well, so what was the Olympic Village like?
I think a lot different than the present day Olympic Village. What I recall is that you had free access. Maybe you just showed your pass and walked in. The security wasn't as tight as what's happened because of, you know, I guess after 72 and the Munich incident and then other things that happened in the world that changed the way we look at things. But I thought, you know, you'd walk in and you could go to the different dining halls. You could eat with the French. You could eat with the Italians. You know, you could eat with the Africans. You could go eat anywhere you wanted in the village. And I thought that was great to just be able to mingle. And, you know, you'd walk and sit around people and you'd say to yourself, I wonder what that guy does. I wonder what she does. You know, it's just sort of, you don't know what people do, what kind of events they're in. But it was great to, you know, see friends that people you'd get to meet over the years and from other parts of the world. And just being part of it, you sort of strut around your stuff and kind of like pump your chest up and say, hey, I'm an Olympian and I'm here. And there's a lot of people that wanted to be there that aren't. And you're fortunate enough to make it and be able to walk around in a close-knit society kind of situation. And, you know, you're there. So I thought it was a wonderful experience to be part of that whole thing.
Sure. Well, what are your memories and experiences from the opening ceremony?
You know, I had my first competition the day after the opening ceremonies. So my wife went and she videoed the whole thing. Not videoed, but it was Super 8 was the media at the time for filming. And I went to the Olympic Village. I was in the Olympic Village and they had a theater and a big screen, big movie screen, and I watched the opening ceremonies there, sitting there crying with a bunch of people. You know, it's kind of very emotional. And when you see things happening and how everything unfolds with the athletes coming in and the flag and the oath and the climbing the stairs and lighting the torch and all that, it's a very emotional, wonderful scene. And it was kind of private for me because I was by myself in the movie theater just sitting there with drying my eyes. So I would love to have participated in the opening ceremonies and walked, but it was more important that I just not stand on my feet for 18 hours or however long it was and just get ready for the race the next day.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, did you have any memorable interactions or experiences with people from other national teams?
Yeah, you did, but I knew a number of people. The thing was is that you don't really get a chance in those days to know a lot of people. I was on a couple of international teams from 64. I competed internationally in 65, 66, and this was 68. So for a few years, it's not like today where everybody goes to Europe and runs, and there's so much media and there's so many races. That didn't really exist back in the mid-60s. So from being on national teams in 65, where we traveled to Russia, to Germany, to Poland, places like that, and being on some smaller teams that competed in France and Germany and Italy and Spain and, you know, Ireland and England. So you'd get to know some people. And then when you would go to the Olympic Games and walk along in the village and on the track, you'd know some people, not a lot, but you would know names and faces. And so you had a couple of friends, but I wouldn't say a great deal. And then you're so focused on yourself, you don't want to become too friendly with people. So you want to just maintain kind of like a standoffishness kind of in a way so that you don't want to get too close to your competition.
Right. That makes sense. Well, with 68 being kind of the height of the Cold War and Vietnam, what effect, if any, did this political climate have on the games and interactions with you know, between the Cold War power countries and those on the other side.
Yeah, we went to Russia in 65, and so we had a taste of Russia being, we had a competition in Kiev, and got to know a couple of the Russians, and maintained some friendship with a couple of them, but they were kind of standoffish. I thought the Russian people kind of were more curious. This was back in 65, more curious to come out and see the Americans. They didn't trust you. They would approach you on the black market trying to buy stuff off your body, you know, your clothes and anything you wanted to sell them. And then when we got to, you know, understand, and I read some information that they would hand out on, it was kind of their society, their master of sports, their sports system. Like the better you were, the more money you got, and the higher standard of living you would maintain. And you could progress through different categories of their sportsman's program. And so this all translated to being kind of professional. So and the guys were a little bit older. And so when you got to Mexico City, I thought they were older people. They were older athletes, and they probably had maybe an advantage because they probably had gotten some money for it, which Americans didn't. And they were, a tremendous sports program, not only just in track and field, but in other sports. They usually win right up there with the U.S. in the medal count. So they were there, but I had not a great deal of interaction with any of them other than a couple of the guys I competed against.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the East German athletes? 68 was the first year in which they had an official team at a Summer Olympic Games. Did you meet any of the East German athletes or have any interactions with them?
No, I ran against one guy, and he made the finals in the 800. I had never heard of him before, and I don't know whatever happened to him after it, but they were coming on. Is that the first year that they had the East and West teams?
Yeah.
They had two separate teams. And I remember
Yes. They
had the DDR and the GDR, and they sort of marched in separately. I knew the West Germans. I'd competed in West Germany before. I'd been to East Germany, but I had competed in West Germany, in Munich, and a few other cities in Germany. And I was more friendly with the Western side. But I didn't know. I ran against one guy. He finished in my race. I was third. He was fifth or sixth. And I assume he was on drugs, but at that time, you know, who knew? But I didn't know him too well other than just to sort of nod my head and say hello.
Mm-hmm. Well, going to your, you know, big final event, what were you doing just prior to that event? Any last-minute preparations?
No, we ran 3 days in a row. I was fortunate because it was the first, second, and third day of the Olympics, and you didn't have to sit around for 2 weeks, you know, waiting for your event. So prefer to just let's go and get it over with. I didn't do anything differently than I normally do. So there was no special preparation, just to try to keep positive. Look at the heat sheets and find out who's in your heat, what it takes to get to the next round, how you qualify, you know, those things. Make sure you know that. Make sure you know what time the race is so that you don't miss the race because of some reason. And just keep prepared and just try to stay loose and rest and focus. I like to stay by myself before a big race, just sort of rest around and not talk to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, 68 is also remembered as kind of a breakthrough year for the Kenyans. Do you have any comments about that?
Yeah, the first time I'd ever, when in 1964, they would put up the heat sheets the night before or the day before, who you're running against. And there might be six or seven heats and say two or three, the first two or three in each race, make the semifinals, that type of thing. And so I was looking through, and I was 20 years old, and I was looking through the list, and I see, you know, the heat that I was in. And I noticed there was a guy from KEN. I never heard of a lot of the guys in my race. And but there was a guy from, it said KEN. I says, what the heck is KEN? I had no idea what KEN was. Ken was Kenya. So the first race I was running, and this is the first round in 1964, this guy went out like real fast, and he must have had 10, 12 yards on the pack. He just kept running. And lo and behold, it comes out that he was Kenya's first Olympic medalist. He finished third in the finals of the 800 3 days later. So that was my first recollection or first take on Kenya. When I first seen this guy, and he was from KEN, I said, the heck is KEN? Then it turned out that he came back in 1968, so I knew who he was then, and he was real good. He finished second, so he got third in 64 and second in 68. So the Kenyans are fantastic. They're fantastic runners in the middle distance and long distance running. Got to know a few of them, got to know Kano. This guy's name, who I ran against, was Wilson Kiprigut. As I said, he was Kenya's first Olympic medalist.
Wow. So, that's neat that you got to run against him. Well,
he was from KEN, and I was trying to figure, what the heck is KEN?
Well, when did you realize that you were going to win a medal, and what did that feel like?
Well, I was kind of hoping to win the race, but my foot was swollen, and not to make excuses, but I don't think I was at my best. But also, I don't know if I would have beaten the two guys who finished in front of me. Unless I had a bicycle kind of thing. I think they were very good. I could have run a little bit faster, but it would have been tough for them. But when we came off the last turn, I saw the first and second were kind of a little bit too far away. And there was a guy from East Germany, a guy named Walter Adams, that came up on me. I passed him. He passed me. We just went stride for stride, going down the last straightaway. And I just, the first time in my life, I almost felt like I needed to reach out and hit this guy. Because he wasn't going back or anything. He kept going. And I was fighting him, and he was fighting me, and I was able to beat him at the finish line. So it wasn't until the last couple of yards of the race that I realized I finished third. Was going to third.
Yeah.
So we had a little battle going.
That's exciting. So did you experience any effects from the high altitude?
Sorry?
Did you notice any effects from the high altitude during that race?
No, I thought that we had been prepared at altitude. The one thing that the one effect, and not altitude wise, but what the Americans have to go through to make the Olympic team is it's a very high pressure type competition. You have to be at your best at the Olympic trials, otherwise you don't go. So I felt that, you know, if you're not at your peak performance for the final Olympic trials in the U.S., if you don't finish in the top three, you don't go. So you need to be prepared for that. So I felt that it got difficult to, after the making the team and the Olympics being a month later, that I felt it a struggle to continue for the next month. And that there's no other way you can select the team other than sort of head-on competition. But I felt that after the final trials to make the team, I kind of came down a little bit, and it was hard to get back up. So no excuses. I ran my best time, and I ran well, and I finished third, and then I was on the podium. But I think other than the altitude had no effect, I thought this had more of an effect on me than anything else. So.
Certainly. Well, can you describe, you know, what was going through your mind and what your emotions were as you were on the medal podium and receiving your medal?
You know, I always thought that if you won an Olympic medal, it would be in a stadium with 70,000 people. It would be this beautiful blue sky, nice and sunny, nice and warm. It'd be this wonderful ceremony. And it didn't really happen that way. It's the race, the 800, was the last event of the day. And we were under the stadium. I guess it was a press thing or whatever it was, and getting ready for the medal ceremony. And it started to rain. And it didn't just rain. It was a monsoon. It was more rain than you could ever imagine. It was freezing cold. My foot was swollen. I had a hard time walking. So you had to walk out from under this under the stadium, across the track, over this muddy grass field, up to the podium in the pouring rain, freezing, to receive the medals. So, and there was nobody in the stadium. So the flags were sort of drooped straight down. Not that that at all mattered, but, you know, just because it's, you know, but you kind of thought that the day you would get your medal would be like this beautiful day. And it turned out to be just pouring rain and freezing. So I always tell that story. It's kind of like funny what you expect and then what actually happens. So, but it was a wonderful thing to get up on the podium. And a friend of mine, a guy named Dan Ferris, presented the medal. And he was an old friend of mine and from New York. And I knew the guy for many years. And it was wonderful to have him do that. And it was wonderful to be there and shake hands and being with two of the best athletes that ever ran the sport in your event.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, what
it was fantastic, you know.
So. Yeah, absolutely. What did you do immediately after you got the medal? Did you, or immediately after your race, for that matter, did you celebrate? Did you call family? Did you relax?
Well, I called my family because they were always they were instrumental in always being at every competition we ever ran and very supportive. And then that evening, I went out to dinner with a friend and his wife, a guy named Tom Laris, who was a distance runner. He went to Dartmouth, and he's a good friend of mine. And we went out to some restaurant in Mexico City and kind of just celebrated, but which was pretty nice. And that was it. And then a few days later, I guess went to Acapulco, and then after that, flew back to L.A.
And so. You continued your work in the service?
Well, the good thing was is that my date to get out of the service was October 1st. So if I it was a win-win kind of situation for me. So if I didn't make the Olympic team, I get out of the service, which was like really good to get out of the service. You know, 2 years in the service is like enough. And then if I made the Olympic team, then I'd stayed in an extra 30 days. And so I was in the Army for 2 years and 29 days. And so. You know, I had to go back and then just process getting out of the service and then look for a job.
Well, that does sound like a great situation, a perfect situation.
Yeah, it worked out well because if I didn't make the team, I got out of the service. So there was like, that's good, but I wanted to make the team and get out of the service. So, you know, that's what actually happened. So.
Yeah. Well, switching gears a little bit, going back to the events and the competitions, So 68 were the first games, first summer games in which like a standard drug testing program was implemented. Do you remember the drug testing and any experiences surrounding that?
No, I wasn't drug tested. I did. The guy who won my race, whose name is Ralph Dubell from Australia, he told me he was drug tested. So, but I guess it must have been a random thing because I was not drug tested at all. And no one ever came up to me. No one, nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. That's pretty much what I've heard. Is that it was, you know, pretty random. Mm-hmm. So, what about the gender verification testing that was implemented at the 68 Games? Did you hear anything about that, or were you aware of that?
No, there was talk about you know, whether Ingrid was Igor, or Igor was Ingrid, type thing. There were a lot of Eastern European athletes that were suspicious. There were some of the Russians, they were, women were suspicious. And then once they implemented the sex test, I guess chromosome test,
mm-hmm.
Many of the elite Eastern Bloc athletes all of a sudden retired. So I think it got to the point where, you know, Igor was Ingrid, you know, who knows?
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. So, were you there for the closing ceremony?
I was. Yeah, the closing ceremonies are fantastic. I just didn't climb up onto the field because my wife didn't. You had to climb over this sort of wire fence and stuff that they had to keep people out. But I thought the closing ceremonies were fabulous. I thought they were fabulous. The freedom of it and. Past years, they would just allow only a certain number of athletes from each country to march in. And it's usually the guy who wins 5 gold medals or the gal who does this or whatever it is. This year, that year in 68, I believe they did the same thing, but kind of the athletes sort of broke ranks and then all climbed over the fence and onto the field. And it was a real joyous kind of celebration. It was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Very emotional.
Yeah.
Just to watch everybody, you know, run around and jumping around and at the close of the games.
Wonderful. That's pretty much what I've heard from most people is that it was, you know, very emotional.
So, oh, very emotional, yeah.
So speaking of some of the other events, you said you got to attend a basketball game. And did you get to attend any other events?
The equestrian. And I think that was pretty much it. I can't recall if I went to anything else. No, I think that was pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
I know I went to the basketball game and paid the guy to at the gate to get in. He let us in. Gave him a couple of pesos and let you in.
Yeah.
Well, they're willing to take money.
Yeah. Did you witness Tommy Smith and John Carlos's protest?
I did. Yeah, I did. And, you know, we knew something was going to happen. It was remarkable that Tommy won the race. I grew up with John Carlos. We're from kind of the same neighborhood in New York City. And I'd known John for many, many years. And I was with him just a few months ago. We knew something was going to happen. So I know my wife and we went and got like front row seats as close as we could get to see what was going to happen. And it's kind of amazing to watch the whole demonstration. Didn't realize, I told John this recently, was that, you know, as time goes by, your feelings and your what actually happened is kind of change. You get better educated as the years go by. When they first did the protest, I didn't realize the statement that they made. I didn't realize that things that they had a scarf on, they had some beads around their neck, they had some things that they wore that all signified something, and that was very personal and very meaningful for them, and should be for everyone. So didn't really know, but you sort of get better educated the older you get and the more you read about it and the more you see. And when they was kind of run out of Mexico, you know, they didn't realize that so many years later that these guys would be iconic, that these guys would be basic heroes on the statement that they made. So
how were others around you acting, or, you know, how did they receive the protest at the time?
A lot of people felt that that there should be no part for it was called a political thing or statements, that this is here for competition, this is for like brotherly love throughout the world. And that there's no place in the Olympic Games for any kind of a statement. So some didn't really want it. Others were, like in the military, you were told sort of stay neutral. But for the most part, you kind of felt that you should have keep things separate. You go compete, and if you want to make a statement somewhere, go make a statement somewhere. It's not until, you know, everything gets analyzed years later as to you realize what they actually were doing, you know, and what the significance of their statement actually was.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a number of years before you realized what they meant.
Right. Well, you said at the time that you thought that they might do something, and what gave you that indication?
Oh, just from the months we were all together that you know, there were a lot of talk at the training camp about a black boycott. Jesse Owens came in, and Harry Edwards was around, and, you know, there was so much media. Now, the life of a track and field athlete is, and I use myself as a reference. In 1964, I was 20. 1968, I was 24. You know, your athletic career is only a couple of years long. And when it came to guys giving years, so that when you make a statement and you're going to be thrown out of something, you know, you're going to think twice before you do something versus, you know, how much time you have left in your sport, so that you don't have a lot of time left and you don't want to throw the years of training out, you know, for a statement. And I think a lot of the athletes felt that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. So you mentioned the media. What are your memories of the media, the TV cameras, photographers, reporters, journalists, and did you have any memorable interactions with the media?
No, because really all the media wants to do is talk to the guy who wins. So when you finish third, when I get back to New York, after the Olympics, I went back to LA, got out of the service, then relocated back to New York City. And I was grew up in New York, went to high school, college, and high school, grammar school, high school, and college in New York City. One of the writers who covered the sport, he came up to me and said, "Gee, Tom, it's too bad you only got third." You know, so that's kind of the memory, is that they only want to cover who the winner is, and everyone else is. We'll ask the winner 17 questions, and we ask the guy who gets third a half a question, you know, that type of thing.
Mm.
So that was what the press does. They just want to talk to the guy who wins.
Hmm. Well,
U.S. winner.
Yeah.
And if you don't finish first, you're the second first loser kind of situation. That's the way this country's built.
Well, what other memorable or interesting events or experiences, you know, just kind of stand out in your mind from the 68 games?
I think just the thing that is that if you accomplished a plan and you had a strategy and everything that you did for, in my case, like I said, I started training for 68 a week after the 64 games ended, and to realize that all of the little things that you do, all of the big things that you do, all of your thinking and your strategy and your focus all translates to making or being a success, let's say, and making this goal happen, is the thing that you keep pinching yourself saying, "Hey, I did it, you know, and you have a lot of support from coaches and from friends and from family and all of that. But, you know, to me, it was just still pinching yourself saying, "Hey, I'm an Olympian," and there's a lot of guys and gals who want to be, who aren't. And to be able to do it twice was remarkable for me, I thought. And I think that's the thing that kind of always sticks out. It was that wherever the Olympics is or whatever it is that was your goal. You want to be the best of the best. You do everything you can to maintain that focus, maintain the physical part of it, maintain the mental part of it, and then you make it. And it's kind of a good feeling.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, what was the reaction of your friends and family to your winning an Olympic medal?
I think they were very happy. I think they were, a lot of them were disappointed that I didn't win. But, you know, I realized that you get beat by guys that were better at the time. So, and that's really all it is. But I think they were all very proud and very pleased and very happy. And I was too. I was really thrilled to finish third. Disappointed, but also thrilled to at least finish third, you know. So everybody was very positive about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me a little bit about how and when or and why you changed or reduced your level of involvement in your sport.
Well, when I finished competing, I had to get something called a job. So. And I thought I was too old, and had a couple of injuries that were nagging, and there was no money in it. So I relocated from the West Coast back to the East Coast and got a job working for Xerox. Although my athletic career kind of helped me to get my job. So, but you had to get a job and make a living.
Mm-hmm.
When I went back to New York, I was interviewing in a few places, and I went into the New York Times. There's a writer friend of mine, a guy named Frank Litsky, who covered a lot of the track meets and things, and we were pretty good friends. So I went in to just say hello. I was walking past the New York Times. I said, "I'm out interviewing, looking for a job." And he says, "Tell you what," he says, "let me help you out." He said, "Let me call over a photographer." And he called over this guy, and the guy took a couple of pictures, and the guy came and interviewed me. And the next day in the New York Times, there was this article in the sports section with two photographs of myself sitting at this desk talking to him. And it's the caption, the headlines of the article was, "Who? Tom Farrell? Oh, yeah, show him in." And it just went on to say what I had done, and I was from New York, and that I was looking for a job. So Xerox called, and I went down and interviewed with Xerox, and that's where I got my job. That's where I started working.
Mm. And how many years did you stay on with Xerox?
32.
And I read that you became an executive at Xerox.
I my title was, I was a global account manager. So what I did was I managed some of the larger accounts worldwide.
Mm. And is Xerox where you retired from eventually?
I did, yes, mm-hmm. yes. That was in 99, so I retired at 55.
Oh, wow. That's nice.
I'll say. I'm happy.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier that you were with John Carlos and Tommy Smith not that long ago.
Just John.
Oh, just John. And what was the occasion?
John wrote a book, and he was promoting his book, and he was invited to speak. I have a brother who is the women's track coach at Princeton, and he's been there for 30-some-odd years. And a group at Princeton, I can't recall, African Studies and something, some other group, invited John to speak, and he could also promote his book. So my brother called me. I happened to be in New York. This was in, I can't remember, it was a few months ago. I can't remember exactly when it was. So he says, why don't you come on down? So there was a dinner before the actual meeting and the thing that John was going to speak at. John and I, we've been friends for many, many years. And then so we went to his talk. And John gave a great talk on, you know, where he came from and, you know, his background and all of that, and answered any kind of questions and all of that sort of stuff. So I spent the evening with John then.
Okay.
And what one of the things he, one of the questions, they had people write questions and ask questions. And so one of the questions was, how did the other athletes on the 68 team feel about what he and Tommy Smith did? So he says, don't ask me. He says, ask Tommy over there. He asked me. So I get up and they asked me, you know, how I felt and how the other athletes felt, which is a lot of things I had discussed before about being, you know, you get better educated as you get older and what the meaning of it was and knew more about what they did and the significance of some of the things that they had draped around their necks and what they had worn and things like that. So it was kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's neat. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about amateurism and a kind of a comparison. What comparison could you make between amateurism in 1968 and 64 versus today?
Well, today it's, I guess if you're a certain level, it's not an amateur sport. Money started coming in. They started paying people to wear shoes in 68. That's when a lot of that had started. But now you're elite athlete, you're top of the rung kind of a guy or gal, can make a living by continuing in the sport so that it's really beneficial. If you can make money, you know, you can extend your career. Now people are competing, you know, into their 30s, where back when I was competing at 24, I didn't have a nickel to my name. You had to get a job. And when I went to Xerox, they said, you can't train or run or any of that. You have to go sell products from us, for us. So it's, you know, you need to make money to live, to pay your bills. So back then it was purely, you did it for the love of the sport. You did it for nothing. It was definitely totally amateurish, an amateur sport. And nowadays people are signing contracts with shoe companies, endorsements on different products. Not a lot of people make, I think, a lot of money, but your elite guy makes a bunch of money. And I think there's, you get some stipends and some, depends on your level, but you can pretty much continue, at least if you have a paycheck coming in.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you a question about Tokyo, just for you to draw, what were the major comparisons that you could make, or in the major differences that you could make between the Tokyo Olympics and the Mexico City Olympics?
Basically, and all of a sudden in Tokyo, Mexico was all, oh, I've been here before. So I felt more, I was more of a not a pro, but, you know, veteran, I guess is the better word. Tokyo was fantastic. I just got so engrossed in the whole thing and living in the Olympic Village and staying with the athletes and walking around Tokyo and going to the different venues. And one thing that was pretty nice that happened to me in Tokyo was when I was in grammar school in in New York, there was a Japanese kid named Kazuo Taki. And Kazuo came over with his father. I guess his father was a businessman. He spent a few years in the States. And we became very close friends. We played a lot of baseball together, and I kind of befriended him. And we became pretty good friends. And then once he left, it was kind of sad when he left, and then he went back to Tokyo. Now, this is where maybe 11, 12 years old. And I had not seen him again, never heard from him or anything. And then in 1964, I was 20, and when I was over in the Olympic Village, he contacted me. How he knew I was there, I don't know, but I guess he maybe followed something or however that worked out. And his father, I think, was pretty well-to-do, so we spent a couple of days together. His dad sent a personal car and his driver to pick us up. They took me to a tea ceremony, took me to Kabuki Theater, went out to dinner, drove around. They sort of took care of me for a few days. And it was a great experience to go renew a friendship with a kid I befriended in Queens, New York. And so he kind of returned the favor, you know, years later in Tokyo. So it was pretty nice.
Yeah, that's a really neat story.
That was a pretty highlight, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Pretty cool.
Well, in your opinion, what is the legacy of the 68 team? So if this project is about preserving the legacy of the 68 team, in your opinion, what is that legacy, or how would you sum it up?
Well, it's considered the greatest track and field team ever assembled. And there were a lot of great accomplishments of individuals on that team. Back in 1998, a guy named Steve Simmons at the USA Track and Field Championships put together a reunion of the 68 team. It was in New Orleans, but a lot of people came. And it was great to see people again. And to realize that the guys in this room, like this guy was a world record holder and did this, and this guy did this, and this guy did that. And to be in this room and be up in a conference room, and each person had an opportunity to go around the room and speak on whatever subject they wanted to speak on, and in regards to the 68 team. It was a very, very emotional thing. A lot of people crying. It was a wonderful scene to be there, and it's just too bad it wasn't documented or filmed, because it was a tremendous moment to be part of this group of guys that got together for a 30-year reunion and you know, spill your guts on whatever you feel. And the things that came out were very personal and very emotional and very very, very wonderful type of thing to be part of. So, I mean, you want to keep that going. It was a wonderful team. There was so much things going on in the 60s. There were you know, the civil rights and the assassinations and I guess the personal expressions of people that were speaking out for things to be better. A remarkable time, and the world situation that was going on at the time. Remarkable time, and this track meet with the best ever to be recognized as the best track and field team ever assembled should be preserved, and we thank you for it.
Well, thank you, Tom, for being so generous with your time and memories. One last question I want to ask before we end the interview. What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Just be focused. Live your dream. When I was in grade school, and I had just remember my freshman year in high school, which was 1957, I remember I put up from Sports Illustrated, I put up pictures of runners from the 1956 Olympic team. And I know who they were. It was a guy named Tom Murphy, a guy named Charlie Jenkins, a guy named Glenn Davis. And they were all gold medal winners. And I put their pictures up on the wall. And I said, I want to be just like these. You know, thoughts sort of began that I want to be just like these guys. And that's, you know, the heart has to be in it. You have to do everything in your power to not, you know, deviate from a goal that you have set, to do everything in your power to accomplish that goal.
Mm-hmm.
And just be positive and keep going.
Sounds like
the journey is definitely worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. Very good advice. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about before we end the recording?
No, I think that's it. I think I can't think of anything else.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm going to stop the recorder, and if you'll hold on the line for just a moment.